Hi, this is Lauren Schiller, and I hope you enjoy the conversations you hear each week on Inflection Point. If there's one thing I've learned from doing this show, and I probably knew it already, you have to ask for what you want. And we want to go national. So I'm asking you to become a patron of Inflection Point. For just 50 cents an interview, you can be a part of bringing women who are changing the status quo to the ears of everyone. That's only $4 a month, about the price of a latte. $4 to ensure that the views and voices of powerful women are heard every week. With your patronage, we can make it happen. Go to inflectionpointradio.org and thank you. Welcome to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, sometimes good intentions don't solve problems, and misunderstandings can make things even worse.
What you do for me, but without me, you do against me.
Redefining solutions. That's our Inflection Point. The traditional philanthropy model is to give money to a cause you believe in, maybe even get your name on a building or a bench, depending on how much you give. Our guest, Pam Scott, has taken philanthropy to the next level by designing solutions with the communities she serves. Her focus is on addressing unintended teen pregnancy in sub-Saharan Africa so that girls can delay starting a family until they are ready. Pam has worked with communities in Rwanda, Ethiopia, and Tanzania. Welcome, Pam.
Hi.
Why have you decided to make reproductive rights your focus?
Well, good question. So my husband and I have been involved with philanthropy for over 10 years. And one of the things we kept seeing over and over again is as children age, girls are less likely to be among the student body. And we saw that that was happening for a number of reasons. And one of the main reasons it happens is that when girls in the developing world become pregnant, they're often kicked out of their schools. And so it made sense to me to not give up our love of supporting education, but also include reproductive health for young girls.
So why are you focused on Africa?
Well, you know,
because that happens here too.
Oh, it absolutely does. And we tend to do our giving sequentially. So we started an education. We started in the United States and really got our bearings there, felt like we were having some impact. And then we took a more global perspective. I'm sort of doing the reverse with adolescent reproductive health by starting in Tanzania, where the issue is so incredibly entrenched. Over half of all births in Tanzania are to teen girls. That's not the case in the United States. So it is an extreme problem in Tanzania. And secondly, it's the second leading cause of death for girls 15 to 19 in the developing world. We don't have that dire a situation in the United States. So I wanted to go where the situation was hardest to see if we could come up with some solutions and then translate that learning eventually to the United States.
So what's the birth control situation generally for girls in Tanzania?
So the first thing to know is that we're not doing anything illegal in Tanzania. In Tanzania, every adult, including adolescents, has a legal right to the contraception that they ask for. The problem is that girls don't have agency over their livelihoods, not their lives, not their bodies, and certainly access to contraception is an issue for them. So if a girl were to decide to become sexually active, and sometimes it isn't by choice, but let's say it is by choice, she might then go and seek out a condom, the birth control pill, an IUD, whatever it is. All the same methodologies are available or in that country as they are to us. But in Tanzania, unmarried girls are shunned when they get to the clinics and ask for these services, or when they go to the pharmacies and they ask for either the pill or the condom. And in fact, not only are they shunned, in a lot of cases we've been finding that the medical community is telling these girls these horrible mistruths about contraception, so that girls are given the impression that rods that get and put under the skin cause cancer, and that IUDs will render them permanently infertile, and in some cases that condoms cause HIV. And the reason these medical professionals are telling these girls these myths is that they actually think that they will keep girls from having sex out of wedlock. they think that girls without contraception will only practice abstinence. Well, clearly that's not the case when over half the births in the country are to teen girls, many of them unmarried.
So married girls can go into these clinics and they don't get told these things. Are they trying to get in the way of contraception for them as well?
Well, I don't want to paint the medical community in Tanzania and these rural areas in particular as bad people. I really think that they are well-intentioned. I really think that they are trying to do right by the culture and the religious norms and the societal norms there. And I will say, yes, there are married women who struggle to get contraception if they don't have their husbands right next to them saying that the husband grants permission for the woman to use whatever form of contraception it is that she's interested in. Women all over the world have very little agency over their own bodies, how many children they have and when they have them, not to mention who they marry. It's kind of astonishing what we can take for granted in the United States.
So what is the situation, even just backing up a step, for girls generally in these rural communities that you're working with, beyond just at what age they're having sex and potentially getting pregnant?
Right. Well, it varies depending on what tribe and what culture, what part of the country that they're in. There are traditions all over Tanzania, but I'm thinking on the East Coast in particular, that deem a girl an adult by the time she starts her first period. And there's actually a ceremony called Ningoma, where girls are welcomed into their communities as women and as adults. And again, it's a celebration around a girl's first period, and she tends to learn about adulthood and pregnancy and parenting and marriage and how to please a man sexually. And the unintended consequence of it is that a lot of men view them as viable sexual targets after they've been through that ceremony. Keep in mind, a girl who just starts her period might be 11 or 12 years old. And so I don't think those are the kinds of circumstances that we can relate to so well in the United States, but that's just some of the cultural norms that girls in Tanzania are having to deal with and navigate.
So what are the situations that these girls are finding themselves in, let's just say before they get married, that would, are they having sex willingly? I mean, do you have a sense of what's happening there?
Well, when we talk about this, it's really important to not suggest that every girl in Tanzania has the same experience or that every family encourages certain behavior of their girls. But one of the things that we did find in the rural villages where people tend to be quite poor is that when a girl starts her period, it signals to her family that she is an adult. And as an adult, she is encouraged to bring in financial resources into her family. And again, she might be 11, 12, maybe 13 years old. And the one asset she has is her sexuality. And so parents are, they have to be pretty desperate in order to do this. Desperate financially, they will turn the other way as she earns money. And girls find pretty early on that they can have sex with their boyfriends for small change and small gifts, or maybe a backpack, let's say. But it's the older men in the village who have more resources and more money. And so that's where they tend to go. And it's called all over the world the sugar daddy effect, But these men also have higher rates of HIV, which is why girls have higher rates of HIV in Tanzania than boys do.
So where you come into this is helping them figure out how to at least not get pregnant, because it doesn't sound like you're trying to solve all of these other cultural issues that are driving them to have sexual relations in the first place.
Well, it's hard. One of the things that's so tricky about anything in the developing world is once you start to see and stitch together the narrative and the social ecosystem that survives around these issues and knowingly or not is encouraging the likelihood that, let's say, girls become pregnant, you realize how many of these issues are interrelated. And so what I do with my team, and I work very closely with IDEO.org and PSI, and we work together to see what is the narrative that is stitched around girls and the likelihood in Tanzania that they'll become pregnant, and where can we intervene to have exponential impact and try to address more than just pregnancy. So for instance, one of the things that I'm really keen on is thinking about when pregnancy is the norm and we want more girls not to become pregnant unintentionally, it's not enough to neutralize the situation. You've got to create a new norm. And part of creating a new norm is to create a reality that they can aspire to that doesn't involve getting pregnant. So what I mean by that is so many girls in Tanzania, you know, if they become pregnant unintentionally, yes, it means they'll probably start out at an even lower level on the economic scale, and so will their children. But it's not as if they're missing out on a fabulous opportunity for this grand life that you and I could imagine here. But what if they could? What if they could strive towards financial independence, and they knew that part of achieving that was not getting pregnant until they were ready? That puts contraception into a narrative that's pretty compelling, but you have to create that reality that they can actually achieve financial independence. So that's one of the things we're looking at is, you know, can we encourage the use of contraception among girls and delay their first pregnancies by creating an opportunity for them that is so compelling they'll avoid doing what is now normal, and that is to get pregnant before they're ready.
Tell us more about the approach that you take in terms of understanding what the situations are within these communities and how you can start to change that narrative without just sort of, you know, parachuting in and saying, and here's your new normal.
Oh, gosh.
I'm sure that's not what you do.
No, golly. So I'm inspired by a quote that Gandhi is credited for have saying, which is, what you do for me, but without me, you do against me. And what I love about that is that it is the antithesis to so much philanthropy, which is what I call armchair philanthropy, where we sit in the United States or wherever we happen to be really comfortable, and we think, well, if we would just blah, 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 and if they would just blah, 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 and everything would be solved. And truly, how dare we? Because we are in the position, or I'm in the position, and so many of us are in the United States, to make a difference in the developing world, just by the very nature we live in the United States, we are in circumstances that are so different from the lives of the people that we aim to serve. So we need to put our assumptions aside, put our ideas aside, and start with humility, and start by truly wanting to understand the issue as it lives in the context of the lives of the communities that we serve. And this is a core tenet of something called human-centered design, which I practiced in the commercial sector, and now I'm so excited to bring to the social sector.
Well, we had Patrice Martin of IDEO in here talking about this as well. So how do you define human-centered design, and how do you use it in your work?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's important to know that if you look at something called the Danish design ladder, there are different levels of design, starting with design as style and aesthetic. That's not the kind of design I'm talking about. Then the next level is design as process, a creative problem-solving process. And then taking it a step further is it's a strategy for getting at innovation. And so human-centered design is about a creative problem-solving process that gets to great innovation. And what's unique about it is that it puts the community that you're serving at the very center of your process. They influence everything that you do, starting with your strategy and how you define what the challenge actually is, and going into the community and, again, learning about their lives and putting the issue in the context of their lives.
So, Pam, what can that new normal look like?
Well, let's back up for a second. And one of the things I love is that recently I read that an economist from the Brookings Institution wrote, if we want to reduce poverty, one of the simplest, fastest, cheapest things we can do is to make sure that as few people as possible become parents before they actually want to. And in the case of the girls, what we know is that a girl who doesn't become pregnant has a much better chance of finishing high school or secondary school, that throughout her lifetime she's going to earn higher wages, that she's less likely, if she delays her pregnancy to, let's say, her 20s, she's less likely to experience complications during that pregnancy and delivery, that her child is less likely to die during childbirth, and that her future children are more likely to be healthy, vaccinated, and able to read. And so if you think about it, the ramifications are huge. We're talking about half the world's young people. And I believe that sort of the meta vision is that when young girls everywhere have the rights and resources to decide when they start their families, we will have a world that is better educated. We will have healthier communities and nations that are better able to thrive in the global economy.
But it just seems like there's so much more going on than just the not getting pregnant part that would facilitate these amazing outcomes.
Agreed. It's a starting point. There's so much more that needs to happen, but when a girl doesn't have agency over her body, nothing matters. We have to start by making sure that she has access to the contraception that she needs and feeling like she has choice to get that in a dignified manner.
So what is your approach to doing all this, to changing to the new normal?
So we're looking at a number of different strategies. The first one is that we want to leverage teen culture. We want to be where teens are and speak to them in their own language. We want to be relevant to who they are and how they want to be perceived. The second thing is we're going to rebrand contraception. We're going to get perceptions in line with reality so that more young women know the actual benefits of contraception. Are there downsides to some of them? Are there side effects? You bet. But we want them to have an understanding of what these actually are, the pros and the cons. We want to enlist the support of men and boys. They've long been cast as the bad guys. We want to give them an opportunity to be part of the solution to teen pregnancy. We want to inspire providers to do their part. This is the medical community that is currently rejecting girls and not giving them their legal access to contraception. And last but not least, we want to create opportunities for girls to thrive financially. And so their financial livelihood is not dependent on who they have sex with and how much they're paid for it.
How do you get families on board? And what about the boys in this equation?
Yeah, the boys are kind of dear, I have to say. So it's important not only in human-centered design to study the people whose lives you're trying to influence, but study the lives of the people around them who are influential. And certainly boys play a role in teen pregnancy, as do men and parents and teachers and imams and priests, and everybody has kind of a role in this human ecosystem. And in the case of boys in Tanzania, what was so dear is that, you know, these girls are, in large part, the very poor girls and uneducated girls are encouraged to have sex for money, and the boys play a role in that. And what surprised me was how much these boys really wanted to be intimate with their girlfriends for the right reasons. They wanted to be cared for, and they wanted it to be more about romance than a transaction. So we're trying to give that back to these communities. Like, if you create opportunities for girls to thrive, they no longer have that kind of transactional relationship with boys or men. And what does that do to the relationships? What does that do to how men and boys start perceiving girls and the intimacy that they have with them? I think great things can happen, but again, we have to figure out this provider piece. We have to get the medical community to embrace their role and understand the power that they have and creating a different reality for girls all over Tanzania.
Pam, you told me that you love hearing how your mom describes what you do.
No. Yeah, it's one of my favorite things. Oh, my mom is so dear. I've heard her describe it that I meet people for a living, which is true. I mean, everything she says is true, but just hearing her describe it is so endearing. How I describe it and how I should be better about describing it so that she does as well, is that my life, work life, is that I live kind of at the intersection of human-centered design and bringing that to some of the most entrenched issues of our day, and advocating for unmarried women to have access to the contraception that they need. And when you bring those two things together, you use human-centered design to address this challenge of teen pregnancy. I believe great things are going to happen. We're just at the cusp of good things happening. I can't say that we have any home runs quite yet, at least in the work that I've been involved with, but there are things that really inspire me.
Well, you were talking earlier about the three types of design, and I understand that you got your degree in industrial design.
I did.
But my understanding is that your dad said, you're not going to make enough money as a designer.
Yeah.
You got to go do something else.
Yeah.
But that when you told me that before we got on the mic, it made me laugh because it was like you had said, I want to be an actor. I want to be a writer.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, industrial designer sounds pretty solid. So what did you end up doing?
So what I ended up doing, and I think I'm only coming to understand this now that I'm in my 50s and kind of looking at my career in retrospect, is that I started to pursue design less as a craft and more as a process. And so I got involved in advertising and started working as a creative strategist and a creative researcher and helping lead creative teams and making sure that the voice of the consumer was always influencing whatever it is we did on their behalf. And so that those are the skills that I started to develop in the social, in the commercial sector that are now translating pretty well, I'm finding, to the social sector.
How did you make that transition from commercial sector to social sector? Was there a moment at which you said, ta-da, I could be doing so much more for the world, or was it more of a gradual
leap? It's kind of both. So I think there are probably loads of people who would love to just say, I am done with the corporate world. I'm going to go work in the social sector and dedicate my life. And I hope more and more people have the opportunity. In my case, the opportunity was that I was working with the social sector. I had a company called The Curious Company. And more we were taking on social sector clients because we were realizing the power of what we did and how that could help unleash more of the potential of these nonprofits. But then I will confess that in 2003, I married a man named Tim Kugel, who is the founding CEO of Yahoo, and no longer needed to work, which was radically upending for me because I come from a solidly middle class family, and it was just unthinkable not to work and like work like your livelihood depended on it. So over a period of, a lot of years, maybe 7 years, I transitioned out of working like a dog for the commercial sector. Didn't stop working like a dog, but just transferred my energy over mostly to the social sector.
So just in terms of being a philanthropist, which is your work, your vocation, your calling, most of us budget our expenses for, you know, food, shelter, clothing, hopefully education. So as a philanthropist, as your job, do you create budgets for how much you're going to allocate to your time, your money, who's getting it? I mean, can you just give us any insight into how that thought process works?
Yeah. So it's just like anything else that you try to budget for. You know you're going to put some money into something. You know you want to see certain outcomes, and you try to figure out what is your role in helping encourage those outcomes. So it's pretty straightforward like that. We do have a foundation that Tim and I co-manage, and we are what I have started to call activist investors, meaning that we don't just write checks. That hasn't been a super satisfying experience for us, and we specifically avoid organizations that limit us to just our check writing abilities, because both of us have skills that go far beyond being able to write a check, as do most people who have ever worked. And so we give our whole selves. So my husband was chair for a while. He was co-chair of Room to Read, which is an international nonprofit. You interviewed Aaron, the CEO. Yeah. And I'm an activist board member of IDEO.org. And we both really give ourselves over to this social sector and trying to see outcomes in our lifetimes.
What's the name of your foundation?
Well, it's a donor-advised fund. It's managed by the Silicon Valley Community Foundation. It's just called the Kugel Foundation, but you wouldn't have heard of it.
Okay. Pam, what's the best advice about philanthropy that you've ever received?
I don't know if it's direct advice as much as there are some people who I greatly admire, and probably Melinda Gates is at the top of the list. What I loved about Melinda, and I will say about Bill too, but Melinda is kind of the one I keep my eye on mostly. I love how she has taken risks in her philanthropy. She sometimes can fund what is typically unpopular. I love how human-centered she is in her approach. Like me, she has a marketing background, and she appreciates so much the importance to satisfy the quote-unquote consumer. Beneficiary and is the language that is usually used in the social sector. And I love how much she is leading by example. This is what she does day in and day out. When I think of what Melinda Gates could, how she could be spending her time, you know, the first thing doesn't come to mind that you're just going to work yourself to a bone, but that's exactly what that lady is doing. And she's holding the bar really high for people like me to say, and not directly, but just by example, to say, if we all did our part, we could make such a difference. And so she's an idol of mine.
Well, Pam Scott, you're an idol of mine.
No.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me on the show today and sharing all the work that you're doing.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As part of our Inflection Point, Redefining Solutions, listen to our interview with Mia Birdsong, whose organization, Family Story, is working to change the conversation in America about poverty.
We have built a deep belief about low-income people that is conflated with our beliefs about women and our beliefs about people of color. And it doesn't allow us to see the barriers we've created that don't allow people to move forward.
That's our Inflection Point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, listen to previous shows and sign up for our email updates. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.